Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Diabetes is the most common metabolic disorder known to affect humans. In the U.S. alone, 30 million people are living with diabetes, and that number is expected to climb to 50 million in the next 20 years. Untreated, those with diabetes will die. Yet we've come a long way in diagnosing, monitoring, and treating diabetes. In fact, many with type 2 diabetes have been able to adopt lifestyle changes to put diabetes in remission. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Dina Irwin, integrative nutritionist at the Community Health Center, who's also a certified specialist in diabetes care and education, about healthy food choices. But first, we talk with Dr. Martin Abramson. He's the Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and previous Chief Medical Officer at Joslin Diabetes Center. And Dr. Sanjeev Chopra, he's the Professor of Medicine and former Faculty Dean for Continuing Education at Harvard Medical School. The doctors have co-authored the book, Conquer Your Diabetes, Prevention, Control, and Remission. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us on the program.
Thank you so very much.
Dr. Abrahamson, people have been living with diabetes for a long time. Why do you think it was important to write this book at this particular time about diabetes?
Well, that's a very good question. And there's two parts to the answer. The first part was that Sanjeev and I have worked together for over 25 years running educational programs for physicians around the country and, in fact, across the world. And he reached out to me when the COVID pandemic began and he said, you know, we should write a book on diabetes. And we discussed it and we came to the conclusion that it was a timely need. And we thought the unmet need related to the book on diabetes was not just to give people facts about diabetes, but rather to include inspiring stories of patients that we've looked after who have overcome many challenges, who have lived with diabetes for many, many years, and who have led highly successful lives in whatever way, shape they choose to do. And so we decided the best way to accomplish our goal was to include in a book information about diabetes, a plethora of information, not just one particular diet, for example, but what diets are available, include new advances that have been made in treatments, which have not been included in many books lately, include new information about the technology that's available to monitor blood sugars, and also then more importantly, to include inspiring stories about our patients who continue to inspire us and in fact make life for us so worthwhile as professionals looking after people with chronic disorders like diabetes.
Dr. Chopra, for those who are not familiar with the disorder, how does diabetes affect our bodies? And what's the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes?
So I'll just add to what Martin said before I answer that question. And that is that he and I also direct, together with Dr. Richard Beezer, an annual Harvard Medical School CME course on diabetes and its complications. And many an attendee will say to us, you know, is there something really worthwhile, something comprehensive, updated, that would be good for our patients or our relatives with diabetes? And that was part of the impetus in writing the book. Voltaire, the French philosopher, once said, every man is guilty of all the good he did not do. So we felt this was our duty. We had to do it. And we have 25 chapters in there. So type 1 diabetes afflicts perhaps 5, at worst 10% of all of those in the universe with diabetes. So it's less common. Type 2 diabetes accounts for 90 to 95%. Type 1 diabetes, we think, is an autoimmune disorder. The body recognizes, the immune system recognizes the islet cells which make insulin in the pancreas as being foreign and attacks it. And there is virtually no production of insulin. And so these patients, and they can develop it at a very, very young age, unfortunately, even before age 1, or develop it much later in life, require insulin for life. There is the promise of stem cells, and our brilliant colleague, Doug Melton, who together with David Scadden, two professors of medicine at Harvard Medical School, head the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, working with a company, Doug Melton, has apparently cured the first patient with type 1 diabetes with stem cells. Wow. He goes to sleep thinking about a cure. He dreams about it. He wakes up and he's at it. And the reason is he has two kids, both with type 1 diabetes. So he's on a mission. But most of the people right now need insulin. Type 2 diabetes is related to lifestyle changes. And with the burgeoning epidemic of obesity, we are seeing so much type 2 diabetes. Between diabetes and pre-diabetes, the estimate is that 1 billion people in the world have diabetes, have this condition, one of these two. And it also, if you asked what organs does it affect? Virtually every organ in the body, perhaps with the exception of the lungs. So the central nervous system, the peripheral nervous system, the heart, the liver, the kidney, the skin, propensity for infections, on and on. So pretty much every single organ in the body. But as we chose for the title, Conquer Your Diabetes, we came across an individual by the name of Wilbur Cross, who has type 1 diabetes. And some 20 years ago, he climbed Mount Everest, scaled the highest peak in the world. There was no continuous glucose monitoring. He needed to check his blood sugar frequently with fingerprints and then adjust the insulin. And then he has scaled all the highest peaks in all the continents. He then made a trip to the poles, 600 mile long trek. What an inspiration. And he's now a principal of a school. He's a motivational speaker, and we reached out to him. And we said, if you have time and the inclination, please read the manuscript. And if you think it's worthy, endorse it. And he gave a lovely endorsement.
You mentioned pre-diabetes. Can you tell us, what is pre-diabetes?
Maybe I can chime in here. I want to just go back for 1 second about type 2 diabetes, because that really does affect 95% of people with diabetes. And as Sanjiv said, it's a burgeoning epidemic, primarily related to lifestyle changes and the growing problem of obesity. There is a genetic component to it, which of course we can't do anything about and which has been about for many years. So what explains this increasing prevalence is the lifestyle issue. People gain weight and they develop what we call insulin resistance, meaning that the insulin that the body produces is just not effective in driving the glucose from the blood into the cells where it's used for energy purposes. And that, together with the fact that then the pancreas starts producing less insulin, leads to increases in blood sugar, which is, of course, how we define diabetes. Pre-diabetes is this in between. It's where blood glucose levels are not normal, but have not yet reached levels diagnostic of diabetes. And of course, the only way you can diagnose pre-diabetes is through blood tests, because people won't have any symptoms of pre-diabetes. In fact, many people who have type 2 diabetes don't know that they have type 2 diabetes, because it's a silent disease until blood sugars are particularly elevated, in which case they start causing symptoms such as excessive thirst and urination and fatigue and visual disturbances and so on. So pre-diabetes needs to be diagnosed with blood tests. And that then brings up the important issue of screening for diabetes. It's a simple test that one can do. There's a test called a hemoglobin A1C, which is now standardized across the country. It's a test which reflects your average glucose reading or glucose levels over the past few months. It was originally developed as a test to monitor glucose control in people who had diabetes. But we now know that because it's such a simple and standardized test, it can be used to measure and diagnose people with diabetes or with pre-diabetes. And then, of course, there's glucose levels, which can be measured in the blood, either fasting or following a glucose load or following a meal, for which there are numbers that reflect normal pre-diabetes and diabetes.
Yeah. So diabetes, you mentioned, or Dr. Schopper mentioned that it affects every organ just about. What are some of the other health issues, even for those who are getting treatment? What are some of the complications that are associated with diabetes?
Let me first start off by saying that we now know that good glucose control, once you've developed diabetes, can reduce the risk for developing these complications that we're talking about. But diabetes primarily affects the blood vessels of the body. And there are small blood vessels, which we call microvessels, and there are larger blood vessels called macrovessels. And the microvasculature that is most commonly is affected is the eye, called retinopathy, the kidneys, we call it nephropathy, the peripheral nerves of the body, we call neuropathy. And then, of course, the bigger vessels are the vessels that supply blood to the muscle of the heart, to the distal limbs, and to the brain. So diabetes can cause these microvascular complications and then can also cause what we call macrovascular complications. It's the commonest, it's a cardiovascular disease is a common complication of diabetes. Stroke can occur more frequently in people with diabetes. Peripheral vascular disease can occur, especially if people have other added risk factors like smoking, high cholesterol, high blood pressure. They all contribute to the increasing risk of these complications occurring in people who have diabetes. But as I said, good glucose control can prevent the onset or even the progression of these complications at their early stages.
So,
chronic liver disease in our country right now is called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And it's called that because under the microscope, it looks just like this person was drinking heavily. Looks like alcoholic hepatitis, but they're not drinking. Or they're drinking very small amounts of alcohol. And who are these individuals? They're individuals with obesity and type 2 diabetes, the metabolic syndrome, hypertension, high triglycerides, insulin resistance. Martin alluded to that. 70 to 100 million Americans are estimated to have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. We have 3-year-olds in our country with fatty liver. We have 16-year-olds with fatty liver and scarring of the liver. And we have 28-year-olds needing a liver transplantation. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease with cirrhosis and complications is now number one cause or number two indication for liver transplantation in our country. So again, what can we do? We can exercise, we can eat the right foods, we can lose weight, we can drink coffee. Coffee lowers the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. 6 cups a day, 40 to 54% reduction in developing type 2 diabetes. And if you already have type 2 diabetes and drink 2 cups, and it can be decaf, it's not the caffeine, regular or decaf, 30% reduction in cardiovascular mortality. So we need a comprehensive approach. Let's prevent it. Unfortunately, if it's developed, what can we do to mitigate the risk of these very serious complications? And the good news is that you don't have to lose. If somebody is 100 pounds overweight, they don't have to lose all 100 pounds to start getting the benefits. Lose 10 pounds, lose 20 pounds. We're now finding studies 5%, 9% of excess body weight, if you lose, you start to see amazing benefits.
We're talking with Dr. Abramson and Dr. Chopra, physicians and co-authors of the book, Conquer Your Diabetes, Prevention, Control, and Remission. And we'll have more after a quick break. If you're listening to The Point, we're talking with Dr. Martin Abramson, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and previous Chief Medical Officer at Joslin Diabetes Center, and Dr. Sanjeev Chopra, Professor of Medicine and former Faculty Dean for Continuing Education at Harvard Medical School. They are the co-authors of the book, Conquer Your Diabetes, Prevention, Control, and Remission. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before the break, Dr. Abramson, you wanted to say something? Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to add to what Sanjeev had said about weight loss. And we know now that you can prevent diabetes by losing small amounts of weight. So if you have pre-diabetes and you're diagnosed with that, loss of about 7% of body weight together with a regular exercise program, which is say, walking 5 days a week for 30 minutes at a time. The sort of standard recommendation is 150 minutes a week of aerobic exercise, together with some strength training exercises. If you lose that small amount of weight, your reduction in risk for developing diabetes or progressing to diabetes is close to 60%. And this is well-demonstrated studies, randomized controlled studies done in the United States, in China, in Finland. The data is almost identical regardless of which country the study is done. So small amounts of weight loss go a long way towards preventing diabetes and also improving diabetes control. So if you have type 2 diabetes, small amounts of weight loss, improved control, and with even more weight loss, there's a significant chance that you can get your diabetes into remission. And that then brings up the issue of, we have a chapter on bariatric surgery in our book as well. Bariatric surgery is the one method of weight loss that is probably more successful than medical management. And so if people do require bariatric surgery, and the indications for that need to obviously be reviewed with their physicians, but include the problems of excessive weight, diabetes, and other comorbidities. And if they cannot lose weight and they cannot control these other comorbidities adequately, bariatric surgery is one of the means of treatment, then with significant weight loss, there is a high probability that they could have their diabetes go into remission or reduce the amount of medications that they need to control their diabetes.
2 years out after bariatric surgery, patients are not taking many of their medicines or taking smaller doses, and the cost savings pay for the bariatric surgery. 60% of patients with significant fibrosis or scarring of the liver or early cirrhosis a year after bariatric surgery have improvement in their liver biopsy, in their liver histology. There is even reversal of early cirrhosis. We shouldn't get there, but that's what the studies show.
Let's talk about insulin for a minute. Many people with diabetes require insulin. The cost of insulin began to skyrocket in the last few years. Insulin discovered in 1921, millions of people require it. Give us a brief history of how it came to be available for diabetes patients and what we know about why the cost has skyrocketed.
You know, Banting and Best, we talk about the discovery, the history of the discovery of insulin in 1921. It's quite incredible to think that within a year of the discovery of insulin, the first patient received the injection of insulin, which brought his blood sugars down dramatically. That was a gentleman, a young boy at the time, 13-year-old Leonard Thompson. Leonard Thompson then lived another 13 years on insulin injections before dying of pneumonia. And Banting and Best, basically, and James Collop, who was the chemist who helped purify the insulin, really they sold the patent that they were awarded to the University of Toronto for $1. Banting said he didn't even want to get involved with the patent because he felt that insulin was for the world. They had made a discovery that was important for the world. Now that insulin was impure. And we've seen huge advances in the development of human insulin. So since the 1970s, we've used genetic engineering, not the pharmaceutical companies, to produce insulin that is identical to human insulin. Before that, it was either insulin from beef or porcine insulin. Then in addition to that, there have been advances to make the insulin more physiologic, because when we inject insulin, we are not really giving insulin the way the body makes insulin. The body is produced in the pancreas and goes straight into the system of the body to exert its effect. We have to give the insulin subcutaneously. It's got to be absorbed, and it's got to go through what we call the systemic circulation before going into the main part of the body where it's required. Pharmacists and chemists have developed ways in which they can modify the structure of the insulin to make what we call analogs of insulin that either act very quickly in response to cover a meal or have a very long duration of action, which is to serve the effect that insulin has between meals or when we are sleeping overnight, where insulin basically controls the amount of glucose that the liver produces, as well as make sure that the body doesn't, the blood sugars are adequately promoted into the other cells of the body. It's probably the cost of the development of these newer generation insulins that has helped drive up costs. I think coupled with that, we have a very complex system of the way in which drugs are sold to the ultimate consumer in this country, from the pharmaceutical company through various wholesalers, ultimately to the retailers. And then there's negotiations that go on with health insurance companies to see which of the insulins can be bought at the cheapest price and so on and so forth. And so that's probably not making the cost of insulin any lower. So I don't profess to know enough about the economics of what's happened to insulin. Part of the cost has been the development of new insulins. Other part of the cost is the system in which we operate. And I think at the end of the day, what we are dealing with insulin as well as with other non-generic products is the fact that people with chronic lifelong disorders have to pay such exorbitant prices for these products that are life-saving. I applaud the president for taking on the idea at his State of Union, where he said that nobody should be unable to afford insulin, and that Congress now wanted to cap the cost of insulin to something like $35 a month. And we'll see where that goes in terms of the Senate. But people should all be able to afford insulin. And how that's going to occur, I think we have to leave it to the politicians.
Let's see what happens. Yeah. What is the prevalence of type 1 and type 2 diabetes in the U.S. population, and how does that compare with other nations? You know, are there certain communities that have been hit harder by diabetes than others, or is it pretty consistent?
The prevalence is now exceeds 10% of adults. So more than 10% of adults have diabetes in the United States. There are some parts of the world where the prevalence is even higher. Some parts of the Middle East, it's as high as 25%. We're seeing increasing prevalence in countries like India and China, where the numbers are just skyrocketing. So if we think that there's going to be a 50% increase in the prevalence of diabetes here in the United States over the next 10, 15, 20 years, that number's probably closer to 70% in some other parts of the world. And it correlates very closely, and we'll probably hear more about nutrition later on in the program, correlates very closely with increasing obesity and a more sedentary lifestyle.
So Martin, in our country, amongst Native Americans, Hispanic population, higher prevalence.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. So, yeah.
So, we noted in the introduction that it's predicted that the cases of diabetes will rise quite a bit in the next couple of decades. Does this relate to what we're talking about, just the increased weight and sedentary lifestyle? We're just seeing more of that. Is that why we predict this?
Yes, I think so. I think that's the reason. That's the main reason why we're seeing that. We're seeing about 1.5 million new cases a year in this country. And my shout out also is to people who are at risk, and these include people who have weight problems, people who have a family history of type 2 diabetes, women who have had gestational diabetes, that is diabetes that is developed or diagnosed during pregnancy that can go away after the baby's born, but they have a high risk of developing diabetes later in life. Women who have a condition called polycystic ovarian syndrome, people with high blood pressure, people with abnormal cholesterol levels, have a higher risk for the development of diabetes, as well as Sanjeev said, people who belong to certain ethnic population groups. The American Diabetes Association now has said that screening for diabetes should begin at the age of 35. But if you have overweight or obesity and one at least one other risk factor, that screening should begin as soon as possible. And if you test negative for diabetes or pre-diabetes, then if you have no other major risk factors, then screening should occur every 3 years, should be repeated. And as the shout out is to people If you think you fit into one of these categories, or if you're 35 or older, you should be screened for diabetes. In the United States, 25% of people with type 2 diabetes are undiagnosed. Wow. And that's staggering.
Yeah. And what happens to these? What happens to those who are undiagnosed? If you don't get treatment, what happens?
They eventually get diagnosed when they have a complication. They're in the emergency room with a complication of diabetes, ketoacidosis, or a rip-roaring infection, or they break a leg, and before going for surgery, we check their blood sugar and it's sky high. And so they get diagnosed, unfortunately, at the wrong point in time. I wanted to add that in addition to our lifestyle, it's the foods we eat, it's an alteration in the gut microbiome. We have a chapter on that in the book. We have 100 trillion bacteria in our gut. It's been called the second human genome, inner bacterial rainforest, newly discovered organ. It has implications in obesity, diabetes, arthritis, liver disease, on and on and on. And we have sedentary lifestyle. You know, the kids used to be out there on the basketball court, and now they're sitting in front of the computer playing computer games. Adults are spending so much time in front of the computer. There's a study that if you are fit and you do aerobic exercises, but you sit for 7 hours at a time, you have increased cardiovascular mortality. Sitting is the new smoking.
Wow. So what could you tell us about the promise of stem cell therapy to cure type 1 diabetes? You touched on it earlier, Dr. Chopra. That's a very promising area, right?
It's a promising area. It's going to be very complicated, but fortunately, we have brilliant scientists who are on a mission. Doug Melton is one of them. And there are stem cell institutes all over the world, including in Singapore, which has put in a lot of money into the promise of stem cells. Stem cell and regenerative medicine. Will it cure type 1 diabetes? Will it let people with spinal cord injury get up and walk? Will it replace organ transplantation? Only the future will tell. But clearly the promise is there, and it starts with somebody believing in it, having fierce imagination. And fortunately, in this time and era and age, there's a lot of wonderful collaboration that goes on between clinicians, scientists, and people in different countries. To me, it's astounding when you look at Nobel Prizes given to more than one individual for work they did in physiology or medicine. Very often, they were on different continents and they didn't know each other. And yet, they came to the discovery at the same time. So I'm very, very hopeful that stem cells, regenerative medicine will make a huge dent in addressing chronic health conditions.
We're talking about diet and lifestyle changes, and that can be difficult to implement, right? So what are some of the successful strategies that you've seen patients use to help them make these changes?
Well, I'm going to be interested to hear what is said a little bit later in the program. But I think there's one important message that I'd like to leave the listener with, and that is, as we said earlier, number one, you don't have to lose a lot of weight to see success, number one. Number two, there isn't really one specific diet that works for everybody. It's really ultimately, what diet can you stick to that is going to work for you? You know, all of us have seen patients who go on these crash diets and they lose a lot of weight. And then within a year, 95% of them have regained the weight. And when I engage people in discussions and we use a technique that we discuss in the book called motivational interviewing to talk to people, it's really trying to identify the little changes that an individual can make in their life that can make a difference to them. And that change does not necessarily universally apply across the board. So some people will say, if I can cut out A, B, or C, I can lose some weight, and then the encouragement is do it. Other people will say, I can maybe cut out D, E, or F. We have a couple of principles about diet that we like to talk about, and that is less carbohydrate is probably better. Of course, less processed carbohydrate is even better, more healthy grains. Healthy fats, there was a time once when it was thought that all fats were bad for you. We now know that what we call polyunsaturated fats or monounsaturated fats are healthy for you. In fact, there was a recent study that said if people have 2 avocado servings a week, they can reduce their risk for developing cardiovascular disease. But avoiding saturated fats, which is commonly found in meat, for example, and having enough protein in your diet is really the approach that people should take in general. There's a lot of scientific data on the Mediterranean diet that shows it's successful. It's successful in reducing risk for developing diabetes, reducing cardiovascular complications if you do or you don't have diabetes. But there are other diets that work as well. Sanjiv will probably talk a little bit about intermittent fasting. That's one approach that people take about to lose weight. They don't eat for X number of hours in the day, 12, 14, 16 hours, and then they can eat food for the other part of the day. And I'm sure we'll hear more about other kinds of diets that people follow later on in the program.
I think our job as physicians, nutritionists, is to make people aware of the scientific results of these different diets. And then say, you may want to try this one, you may want to try that one. And they offer patients experiment, and then they find, this is the one that works for me. As Martin said, the best diet is the diet that the patient can adhere to. Intermittent fasting seems to be pretty good. I know dozens and dozens of friends, colleagues, patients who've lost significant weight on the intermittent diet, which in essence is not eating for 15 or 16 hours. So if your last meal is at 6 p.m., you don't eat anything till 10 a.m. the next morning. And then in the next 8 hours, you can eat pretty much what you want, as much as you want. The only thing you can drink in the morning is coffee. And people lose weight. In our book, we recount 3 patients who went on intermittent fasting. They had type 2 diabetes. They were on insulin. One of them had been on insulin for 25 years and came off insulin. Wow. There's a wonderful review article in the New England Journal of Medicine about a year ago about intermittent fasting. So many different diets work, and I'm sure we'll learn much more from the nutritionist later in the show.
So what are some of the things about diabetes that you wish everyone knew?
I think we would want them to know that you can prevent it, you can control it, you can go into remission, you can live a full and rewarding life, you can conquer anything. Sir Edmund Hillary was the first person to climb Mount Everest with the Sherpa Tenzing Norgay. And he was asked, what was the crowning achievement of your life, being the first person to climb the highest summit? He said, no, all I did was leave a footprint on a mountain. It is not the mountain that we conquer, but ourselves. So we can conquer our diabetes. I have a lot of people in my family with diabetes, and many of them, I have a friend, he is so disciplined, his hemoglobin A1C is less than 6. He's got continuous glucose monitoring. He has discovered, see, everyone's physiology is different. Everyone's microbiome is different. He has discovered that if he goes up and down a flight of stairs from his ground floor to his bedroom 4 times, there's a greater lowering in his blood sugar than if he does 30 minutes on the treadmill. He's found no difference whether he has white bread or whole wheat bread. The one refrain we tell all our patients, friends, and colleagues, do not eat, do not use artificial sweeteners. It actually causes a greater excursion of the blood sugar, changes the gut microbiome. There's a study a few years ago that if you have a diet soda, 1 can a day, you have 3 times the risk of stroke, 3 times. Wow, so get rid of artificial sweeteners, eat healthy food, eat nutritious food, vegetables, fruits, a little bit of seafood. Don't have steak every day. Again, if you eat steak, the gut microbiome converts it into a product called TMNA, and that is linked to atherosclerosis.
I'll add to one other thing about what's the take-home message for people. Diabetes doesn't define who you are. Diabetes doesn't control you. You control your diabetes. You define who you are. There isn't a thing that you cannot do. And I've included some patient stories about this in our book of people who walk in feeling totally devastated with this diagnosis. And at the end of my part of my role is to coach people and to be, as one of my colleagues once said, a specialist for diabetes should be regarded as a friend with a special knowledge to help people and empower people to take good care of themselves. And so there isn't, what I tell people is there's nothing that you cannot do. Will Cross showed us he can climb Mount Everest. I have a patient who's an airline pilot who for many years was not able to fly commercial airlines because he needed insulin. Fortunately, we've lobbied. The FAA has now changed its ruling in line with many other countries in the world. And because of the advent of continuous glucose monitoring and more sophisticated insulins, and even now insulin pumps that have got technology embedded in them that they can communicate with these glucose sensors that measure their blood sugar and adjust the rate of infusion of insulin and so on, these pilots who previously were grounded are now flying commercial airlines. And they are fulfilling their dreams. All this patient wanted to do was fly an airplane, and he's back flying. So there isn't anything that you cannot do. Diabetes right. does not define who you
define
are.
Who you are. Dr. Martin Abramson and Dr. Sanjeev Chopra are co-authors of Conquer Your Diabetes, Prevention, Control, and Remission. We'll post a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you both for taking the time to be with us and writing the book. We appreciate that. Coming up after break, changes in diet and nutrition for a longer, healthier life. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. We know that diabetes can be controlled through changes in diet, exercise, and weight loss. But making those changes can be challenging. Joining us to discuss how to get started and ideas for healthy and delicious foods is Dina Irwin, integrative nutritionist at the Community Health Center, who's also a certified specialist in diabetes care and education. Welcome back, Dina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So when you see patients who've been diagnosed as pre-diabetic or diabetic, what are the biggest concerns when it comes to, you know, change in diet?
Yeah, it's like we heard earlier, it's challenging for folks to do that. But it's also, I think it's really empowering what we just heard too, that we have control over it. And you can't always do it alone, right? So get a team. You know, at the Community Health Center, we have, you know, folks come in and see me, and they can also see the entire healthcare team. We have things like shared medical visits for people with diabetes, where people get support from one another, you know, patients support one another, and they also meet with the entire healthcare team all at the same time. So they get all of that wonderful support that can help people make changes.
All right, so certainly limiting sugary foods is important for all of us, not just those with diabetes, but it can be easy to forget that foods with a lot of carbohydrates fall into that category. So talk about the difference between a complex carbohydrate versus a simple carbohydrate, and are they equal concern for people with diabetes?
Yeah, I think for all of us, it's good to focus on the quality of the carbohydrate. And you mentioned complex carbohydrate. I like to think of it more as an intact grain, like the more intact the food is, the more fiber it's going to have. If you take, for example, oats, right? So Irish steel cut oats compared to Cheerios, both made of oats, but they're going to have a totally different impact on your blood sugar. So the, you know, whole grains, and the key there, if you're looking at food labels, is 100%. So anything that says 100% whole grain, in its most intact recognizable form,
You know, it takes me a lot longer grocery shopping now, reading the labels, right? But it's worth. So when we're looking at the labels, you know, and even like when something as simple as frozen vegetables, I didn't realize sometimes they put salt in it. So sometimes it'll just say, you know, peas, or sometimes it says peas and salt, right? So looking at that label tells you a lot. And when there's a whole bunch of things that you don't even know how to pronounce, probably not a good idea.
I know, food companies are so sneaky. So when I'm teaching people how to read food labels, we don't even look at the numbers or the percents or anything on that label. I teach them just to read the ingredients. And like you said, like peas should have peas, and you know, peanut butter should have peanuts, and not high fructose corn syrup and hydrogenated oils and all that other stuff. And I really want to reinforce too what we heard earlier about avoiding artificial sweeteners and a lot of foods that you would not even expect to have artificial sweet to have those sweeteners are in there, like low carbohydrate bread. For example, a lot of those products have at least two different artificial sweeteners in them. Like, why would you expect to have that in bread?
Does it help to focus on what we can eat instead of creating a list of what we can't have? And how do you help people start to create that list?
So yeah, focus. I love to use an abundance model, focusing on all the delicious foods that we can and should be enjoying. So think about foods that are vegetable forward, right? So, you know, a predominantly plant-based plate is great. So think about your vegetables, like you just mentioned, frozen peas. Vegetables can be fresh, they can be frozen. If you have some whole grains on the plate, legumes, things like chickpeas, kidney beans, black beans that you can buy already made, ready to eat in a can. So you could make a delicious meal just with like a can of black beans, some brown rice, some frozen onions and peppers, and you got black beans and rice, you know, a couple of little condiments in there.
I think people might be surprised. I recently started working with a new trainer to kind of get my exercise thing going again, right? And she has me logging my foods. And when she asked, how's your diet? I said, oh, I think it's pretty good. I was amazed at the amount of carbohydrates I ate that I did wasn't even aware of. So sometimes that's helpful, just sort of keeping, excuse me, track of what you eat and then adjusting, like to put a little more protein in your diet, right?
Absolutely, and that's just bringing some of the mindfulness into it as well, right? So it's by tracking, you're becoming a lot more mindful of what you're, you know, what you're eating, and it's not necessarily tracking your intake to say, okay, well, you know, I can only eat so many calories, or I went over my limit for the day, or I ate a piece of chocolate and now I blew it because I have to write it down in my, you know, my app. It's more tracking your intake to be mindful and to recognize things that you can be adding and maybe doing a little different.
So if you had to come up with a one-day meal plan that meets diabetic guidelines and was delicious, what would be on the menu for breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
Oh, that's such a good question. I would do like maybe for breakfast some avocado toast on Ezekiel bread with maybe some smoked salmon on it, which is one of my personal favorite breakfasts. For lunch, maybe something like a Buddha bowl that has some quinoa and some roasted vegetables left over from the night before, and maybe some sunflower seeds on it, and olive oil and vinegar, and maybe some sardines and mustard. That sounds delicious. I'm actually describing my breakfast and lunch for today. And and then for dinner, maybe it's a stir fry with a bunch of veggies like snow peas and mushrooms and broccoli and some brown rice and some edamame beans, all tossed in with some garlic and just ginger and wonderful flavors, which will be my dinner for tonight as well.
And sometimes I think if you're thinking ahead, being prepared, I know I was very happy to see that my husband had just sort of lightly blanch some snow pea pods, since you mentioned that, in a bowl in the refrigerator. And I go for, if that's something like that, I grab that instead of maybe a handful of crackers, right? So just having that stuff handy is helpful. So there are people who like avoid diets, right? While others find diet guidelines helpful. Are there diets, for example, the paleo or Mediterranean, that might be helpful to people living with diabetes? I think the doctors mentioned the Mediterranean diet.
I would go with the Mediterranean diet, or there's even a subset of the Mediterranean diet mixed in with the DASH diet. It's the Omni. I should know the name of it. It's like the Omni Mediterranean diet, but something based on Mediterranean diet, limiting red meat for sure, including more plant-based proteins for sure, like the legumes and less animal proteins.
Yeah,
but lots of veggies.
Right. So how important is portion control for people with diabetes, and how do you help them get a handle on what's an appropriate portion size?
I think that goes back to the mindfulness and listening to our body's signals and, you know, eating really slow, enjoying what we're eating, and paying attention to when we're starting to get that fullness signal and stop eating when we're about, you know, 80% full. That's the, you know, our individual bodies telling us, okay, that you've had enough food.
Have you found that people who are able to make these changes to their diet can effectively manage their diabetes? What are you finding in your practice?
Yes. And that's the empowering part. It's like I said, it's not easy to do. And it's not perfect, and it's a journey, and it's, you know, that journey is a bumpy road, and it can be done. Absolutely.
What are some of the most common misperceptions about diabetes that you've come across in your practice?
That it's not controllable, that, you know, people tend to get very upset when they're diagnosed, and sometimes they have a little bit of denial as well. And I can certainly understand those feelings. But then they come to realize that, okay, well, I have control over this. I can prevent complications from happening.
And you've actually had patients who have been able to put their diabetes in remission, right?
Yes. Yeah. So, and remission is possible. Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you, like the doctors were talking about, they have some stories of inspiration in their book. Do you use your patient stories to inspire others?
Yeah, they all inspire me. we all have our own journey, and, I learned so much more from my patients, I think, than they learn from me. They're all very inspiring.
Dina Irwin is an integrative nutritionist at the Community Health Center. She's also a certified specialist in diabetes care and education. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for the tips, Dina. We always appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.